back from Dubai for about 6 weeks. So if I'm still emotionally raw, I'm not going to ask you to forgive me, but understand that a lot happened there that was very emotional. So you may hear my voice cracking every once in a while. The mic's not working?
No.
Do I need to get close to it?
Keep talking normally so we can...
All right. So, is that better?
Yes.
Much better? Much, much better? Is that better? Okay. Do you have it in the back? Really good? So just by way of introduction, my name is Paul Simons. I am a co-editor of Modern Slavery magazine, which is an anarchist magazine. You'll see free copies in back of our first issue, which is about 2 years old, if you want to take a look at that. I also do some writing for a number of other magazines within the anarchist milieu, primarily kind of post-leftist type of material. I was an editor of Anarchy, a Journal of Desire, Armed in the 90s, and then in the 80s was involved in the Tompkins Square Park riots. So, been doing this for a little bit. So, I want to start out in terms of going kind of through the trip and then talking a little bit about some of the politics that happened and some of the things that I experienced. And I also, even though this is a large crowd, if you have any, like, really things that you want to discuss, or if I say something that you don't understand, please stop me so that we can go over it. That's okay. I don't mind if it goes a little bit longer as a result of that. So about a year and a half, well, about 13 months ago, for those of you who remember, the siege of Kobani occurred, which is where ISIS, which was infiltrated through the Turkish border, attacked the town of Kobani, which is the capital of Kobani Canton in Rojava, and a month-long fight began between ISIS and the forces of the YPG and the YPJ. YPG is, and I have some Kurds here, so I'm not even going to try to pronounce them. YPG, People's Defense Forces, YPJ, Women's Defense Forces. So that's what those two things stand for. They're both militias, they're not armies, and that's real important for us to understand. So militias, not armies, and we'll talk about that difference too, because that's actually right now that's being hashed out in Rojava with the U.S. military, because they don't understand what a militia is. Because they're used to taking territory and giving it to rich people, right? So after the siege of Kobani was over, we began to get all sorts of information on what was happening in Rojava. And it was very interesting from an anarchist point of view, because it seemed to be based on the writings of Murray Bookchin, Foucault falls into that category. And the person who had kind of synthesized all this stuff, Abdullah Öcalan, who was the head of the PKK, which is the Kurdish Workers' Party, had developed a number of ideas known as democratic confederalism, and that these were currently in the process of being implemented in Rojava. So that was interesting to us. I did everything that I possibly could to get my hands on everything in English from Rojava, from the mainstream media, from SAS, that type of thing, and then published in the anarchist internet press a statement with my name under it supporting the Rojava Revolution. And it generated some really interesting comments and topical stuff and you know, discussions around the PKK and kind of their history, that type of thing. So that planted the seed with me. In May, I was living in a small town in Pennsylvania and was sitting in my office one day, and I got thinking, and I said, you know, if this was August 1936, I would go to Spain to see the Spanish Revolution. And I said, but it's not, you know, it's May in 2015, and there's a revolution going on that looks like it may be an anarchist revolution, and I should go see it because I have a little bit of money and I have a little bit of time. So that kind of, I started putting feelers out into the Kurdish community through friends of mine in Los Angeles, made contact with a gentleman who whose brother worked in the KRG, which is the Kurdish regional government. We'll get into these specific, all these various organizations and governmental authorities in a minute. But he worked in Iraq in the Kurdish regional government and kind of got me started. And then I made contact with folks in the Alliance of Rojava, which is the group that's bringing the foreign fighters over. And they encouraged me to come. And I went first to Istanbul. And then through contacts that they set me up with, a Skype contact in Rojava, got me across the border. So, and we'll go into that in actually just a minute. But I want to cover what Rojava looks like first. Can I get the next slide? So this is the pink area is Syria, the brown area is Iraq. The orange area is the Kurdish regional government, which is right now it's considered an autonomous region, but they recently applied to the UN for nation state status. This is a Bush baby. This was when Gulf War II happened. The Bush administration promised the Kurds that if they rose against Saddam, they would not let them go this time, but they would help them form a regional government so long as the Bush, you know, and his family and all the oil people had access to the oil, which is exactly what happened. So this, in many ways, is a classic neoliberal or neocolonial neoliberal state, with a whole lot of money being dragged out of it, and a whole lot of money being made by the people at the top, which is primarily a family named Barzani. And then the yellow area is Rojava. So to orient on Rojava for a minute, right below Derek, which is in the upper right-hand corner, is the crossing at Fesh Habur and Samelka. And Fesh Habur is on the Iraqi side, and Samelka is on the Rojava side. And it crosses the Tigris River. So that's where I came across. Kamishlo, you can see at the top there. Kamishlo is the capital of Jazeera Canton, and Jazeera is spelled C-I-Z-E-R-E, but pronounced Jazeera. So some of the Kurdish Latinizations are kind of difficult to translate. And then Kobani is the capital of Kobani Canton, and then Efrin over in the corner is the capital of Efrin Canton. And Efrin Canton is currently cut off from the other two cantons by virtue of a column of ISIS basically control that goes up and touches into the Turkish border right at the town of Jarablus, which is where most of their oil is flowing across the border and money is coming back and funding ISIS activities. So that's what that looks like. I should also say that there is currently no federal per se government in Rojava. There are three cantonal governments, but there's no overarching federal government at this point in time. Okay, so it's three cantons working together. And they participate and act as different cantons. It's a very interesting situation. People from Jazeera will ask where other people are from. Oh, we're from Kobani. Oh, really? And they'll discuss, you know, things that are happening in their respective cantons. So, and then there's one more slide. The next one. This is ISIS attack points, support points, that type of thing. And the only thing that's really relevant for us here is that you'll notice that in Rojava, the three attack points are up in the, where three major towns are, Kamishli, the other one is Sarakanye, and then the other one is Kobani. So those are still considered attack points. And this is as of, this map is about 3 days old from CNN. So if you believe CNN, believe this map. If not, your choice. So that's kind of what it looks like. So anyway, I made it to Samelka. Now, I want to talk a little bit about getting across the border, because getting across the border is not easy. So they told me, I flew from Istanbul to Afrin, which is the, Erbil, which is the capital of the Kurdish regional government. The Kurdish regional government does not have a lot of love for what's happening in Rojava. The Rojavans don't have a lot of love for what's happening in the Kurdish regional government. There's not a lot of, the separate populations of Kurds don't see eye to eye on a number of things. So that's kind of problematic. I was told that I could get across the border as long as I had a press card. So when you take a look at Modern Slavery, you'll see exactly the type of magazine that it is. So I had my compañera make up a press card, you know, that she downloaded off the internet from some organization or group, and put my picture on it. And so I walked to the border and I flashed this thing at, you know, the consulate people there, and they said, oh, of course, you know, we've heard of Modern Slavery, we'll let you across. I thought, oh, you've heard of Modern Slavery. It's like I identified the two readers in the entire Eurasian continent of that magazine in one day. So they let me across the border, and just to, so we can start the slideshow now. So the first one is, next slide. Oh, let's start. This is a Syrian refugee camp. There are still small Syrian refugee camps run by UNHCR. This camp, I was told, was about 10 times larger than the one you currently see. I wanted to do some interviews in this camp, but I wasn't allowed to. They said that we'll let you go in, but you can't touch anybody. And I said, I'm not willing to go under, you know, some type of guidance like that. That's too creepy. So I decided not to do any interviews in this refugee camp. You gotta get a feel for it, as well as the fact that outside of this refugee camp are people selling water, cooking oil, tomatoes, cucumbers, chickpeas, rice, that type of thing. So it indicated to me that whatever is going on inside, clearly there's not enough food that's being made available to folks. And that was just my own perceptions, but there were a lot of people selling food outside. And then the next one. This is the KRG side of the Feshabur border. So this is Feshabur. That's the Tigris River. This is actually a pretty extensive compound. It has two restaurants. It has several buildings. And then the flag that you see waving there, that's the flag of the Kurdish regional government. So I'm in a Kurdish regional government launch that's taking me across the Tigris. And then as I'm approaching the Tigris, I'm seeing on the other side just exactly what the anarchists have in terms of their welcome into Rojava, and it looks like this. Can I get the next slide? It's a tent and a couple of cartels. So this is what it looks like on the Rojava side. This is their greeting center for people coming into Rojava. Now, the person that I had been in contact with through Skype had set me up with the Amuda media office out of Amuda, which is associated with the Jazeera Canton. So I got in contact. Can I get the next slide, please? So you'll see that there's a little tent up there, and you can kind of see those dark figures. They're actually clothed in green. Those are a Sayish, and those are the internal security people in Rojava. They're responsible for flow of trucks and cars on the roads and things like that. They're not police. They don't patrol. They don't arrest. They're just internal security folks. Okay. So they're similar to the YPG and the YPJ, and there are female and male Sayish, but they're not associated with the militia. They're specifically an internal security force. So they're up there, they're looking through some bags. I mentioned my name to one of them. They said, "Oh yes, we've been waiting for you." I was brought up to what was once the Syrian offices welcoming people across the border. Sat down with a couple of members of the Jazeera Canton. We talked a little bit. I told them the reason that I'd come to Rojava, and they thought it was a pretty good idea. So they set me up with a driver and a translator pretty much immediately. The two things, just to get back to what my interest was, I was very interested in ascertaining two things in Rojava. First, as an anarchist, I want to know, is this an anarchist revolution? In other words, can we say that a nation state, as we understand it, as we define it in the West, exists or doesn't exist in Rojava? And the other piece was, what do these revolutionary organizations look like right now? What are they doing? Where is power flowing? How are they responding to some of the needs and the individuals who are, obviously, you'll see in some of the photos, there's some pretty desperate situations currently happening, especially in Kobani Canton. So that was what I came over with. And they said, "Well, you know, most of the people here want to go meet with the YPG and take pictures of the YPG." And I said, "I don't want to do that." I said, "I'm not here to see the war. I'm here to see the revolution." And that kind of surprised them. They didn't know how to respond to that, because it was not the typical New York Times request. So,
did they know that they were in a revolution?
The people I talked to knew very well that they were in a revolution. The journalists I talked to didn't want to know that they were in a revolution. It was definitely something that CNN, I met with them, I met with a reporter from Der Spiegel, and until my report came out, the New York Times had never reported that there was a social revolution happening in Rojava. I don't know if it was me. I would like to think that, but you know, those New York Times reports that finally came out a week and a half ago or something, those were surprising to everybody, I think. You know, the global paper of record finally recognizes the fact that something's happening socially. Crazy. So, moving on. I want to give some ideas to what the ground looks like in Rojava. So I'm from northern Colorado, like around Fort Collins, Greeley, that area. And this looks to me a lot like northern Colorado, with the bluffs, that type of thing. We can get the next one. An Arab gentleman, this is an open dump, kind of a classic for, you know, that area. So it's one of the things that the Rojavans are going to, I think, address at some point in time as a result of their emphasis on ecology. And then the next one is three boys looking for trouble in Rojava. And you'll notice the tower in the background? That's the Turkish border. That's the Turkish border. So virtually everywhere I was in Rojava, anytime I looked to the north, I could see Turkish border outposts. So that's how close some of this stuff is. This is a typical village. Most of the villages are between 75 and 225 buildings. They house between 50 and 100 families. Most of them were established 500 to 1,000 years ago, and most of those families have existed in those villages for up to that period of time. Where I was in Rojava, they were represented primarily by Kurdish and Arabs. Up along the border, it's a lot more, there's a lot more Christian villages. And Christians have a tendency, the Assyrian Christians have a tendency to live in villages separated out from Arabs and Kurds. Just as an example, the Christians form their own culture, they have their own language. It is truly its own culture. And this is a Christian community that was formed sometime around 300 after the death of Christ. So it's a pretty old religious community, and not, you know, not associated with what we would, I mean, Gnostic as opposed to, you know, traditional Christianity that we get in the West. So very different. This is Qamishli, and Qamishli is a really big, thriving town. It's about 230,000 people. I kind of like this view because it kind of shows the flags across the street, like the flags that we have here. It gives a feel for the visual effect of the revolution, which is having some type of impact on virtually every piece of people's lives in Rojava. So this was just kind of a visual. So by way of example, the flag, the gold, red, and green is the flag of Free Rojava. The yellow and green flags are YPG and YPJ respectively. The flag that's hung up in the middle is a Tevdem flag, and Tevdem we'll talk about a little bit later. It's a really important newer institution that we're seeing do a lot of important stuff on the ground in Rojava. And then the next one is an HPC banner, like this one. And the HPC is a new militia that's been formed that's responsible for communes. We'll talk about them. And then up in the corner, you can just make him out, is Abdullah Öcalan's face next to a bird of peace, a dove. And so that's kind of what the streets look like. And then across the street, because Qamishli is split into two groups, one is Syrian and one is Kurd. The Syrian government still operates in pieces of Qamishli. They operate the airport, and they also operate the post office. So a lot of the sovereign responsibilities that the Kurds have decided not to take on yet, they've allowed the Syrians to take on. And what we've seen in right now is the Kurds are in the process of changing that. For those of you who've been following it, the Kurds are no longer willing to allow the regime of Bashar Assad to survive. And as of 6 months ago, that was not the case. They were more than willing to try to work with the Assad regime. Now the Assad regime is considered anathema, and they want to eliminate it as rapidly as possible and implement something they call Free Democratic Syria. So that's new. That's relatively new. Can we get the next slide? This is Syria, across the street. The Kurdish culture, from what I saw, had become relatively secularized, to initially come through Istanbul, and then Erbil, and then to go through Rojava, is to see progressively fewer mosques on the street, fewer individuals dressed in traditional garb, that type of thing. Kurdish women will still cover their hair, but in a lot of cases, I think that Islam has basically become part of the culture for the Kurds, and has become less and less important as a religious standard. And I think that this battle with ISIS has definitely driven home that point to a lot of Kurdish folks. So this is just coming out, and it was an interesting silhouette, so I figured I had to take a picture of it. All right, so the next day, I met with the folks at the media office, and they said, well, it may rain, so we want to get you to Kobani as soon as possible. And I said, well, will it wash out the roads? I said, no, but it can be a mess, and it can be hard to get to, so why don't we just send you there now? And I said, that's fine, I'll go to Kobani now. So they sent me to Kobani. This is, at the very top of this hill is an Assayish checkpoint. And this is one of the ways that they stop or slow traffic down on the road. So if I'm suicide bomber, and I see this, I'm going to drive up this hill as rapidly as possible and try to kill the Assayish at the top. If I'm just a normal Kurdish person or somebody, you know, who wants to live that day, I'm going to drive really slow to the top of this hill and make sure that the Assayish see me and know that I'm friendly, right? So there's only maybe four or five of these on the road between Amuda and Kobani, but they indicate to us how important it is that Kobani remain in Kurdish hands. And the YPG and the YPJ do not want to have to fight for that town one more time. So that's pretty clear. And then with the next slide, this is a mine that was on the road in the morning that I was there. This mine had just exploded probably 12 hours ago, and it exploded and didn't hurt anybody, which was good. So right behind me, as I'm taking this photo, about 2 miles, is a piece of this road that's been destroyed by Turkish shelling as well as by ISIS shelling. So my driver and I were instructed, it's time for you to get off the road. And we had to make a huge detour around a couple of villages to come back and to get onto this road again. In the process of that detour, we came across a militia. And my driver stopped, and we talked to the militia for a minute or two. And my driver, just as we were leaving, asked one of the militia guys, YPG? And the guy, you know, shakes his head and he says, no, we're in the, and he gives another acronym. And my driver, I saw, wince. And I was like, that was when I started to get nervous. It's like, oh boy, you know, I don't want to be a statistic. I don't want to make it onto WikiLeaks. So, he and I pulled him over and I said, so what's the story? And he says, oh, it's Syria. You don't need to, you know, need to worry about it. So this little town that we were driving through had declared for Syria and had a Syrian flag flying from one of the roofs of one of the official buildings. And that, so the YPG and YPJ, that kind of indicates to them that there may be ISIS supporters in town. So that, like I say, this is one of the reasons why it was a little bit unnerving. And I could tell my driver was nervous as well. So when we went through this town, we came across this next slide. So this is ISIS graffiti, which has been painted out by somebody, probably YPG or YPJ, somebody associated with the Rojava Revolution. And what this graffiti likely says is when Daesh or ISIS took over a new town, they basically would put up signs that would say, to the infidel, you have three choices, convert, leave, or die. So at least some of the graffiti here from Daesh will say something along those lines. So it indicated that this town at one point in time had actually been in ISIS hands. And the next slide. This is coming into Kobani directly from the east. And these are obviously concrete barriers painted blue. The next slide. So this is a berm that they have, a berm of earth that they have dug. And then there's also a tank truck directly underneath it. And then this field directly off to our right is mined. That is just as we're coming into town, this wall of earth goes all the way to the Turkish border. So that's probably 4 or 5 miles from where we are right now, or where we're standing, where I'm taking this picture. We have a Kurdish woman in the audience. What does that say? Welcome? Welcome to Kobani. I thought it might say something like that. So this is the outskirts of Kobani, just as you're coming in from the north and the east. Or the south and the east, excuse me. And then with the next slide, some of the cleanup has finally started to be done in Kobani. They have had a very difficult time being able to put together the resources to be able to even to begin to clean the rubble out of the town. So these are rubble fields that are being thrown together as a result of the rubble that's being cleared from the center of town. And there's probably a good mile or two of these as you're coming into Kobani. And then the next one. These are cars that they've dragged out of Kobani, and each one of these cars, the big concern there was is that they're starting to notice that Daesh is beginning to mine things that they're leaving behind. So by way of example, I met with a couple of guys from the Miners Advisory Group, or the Mines Advisory Group out of the UK, and those are the guys who go in and defuse mines that they find. And they had just defused mines in a Christian village. And these Christian village mines basically have been placed not as strategic or tactical mines, have been placed as terror mines. So literally it was like they found a cabinet where children's clothes was. This cabinet, if you pulled it open, the mine would blow up. So basically they were trying to kill as many Christians as possible as a result of them leaving the town. Very interesting. So each one of these cars had to be gone over with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that they weren't mined. When they found that out, they were pulled out of town. So they sit out in town, and then eventually they'll be destroyed or sold for scrap or what have you. This is downtown Kobani. This is looking up to Mishnur Hill. And the next one? Downtown, right downtown Kobani. And that building, you can see, has just been pancaked flat as a result of probably an American airstrike. Looking off towards the bazaar, you can actually see that red flag in the far end. That's a Turkish flag, so that's the Turkish border right there. This is right next to the bazaar. This is Freedom Square, as you can see the eagle. And that eagle they put up after the siege was won. So, that gives you a feel for what that looks like. Russian tanks, old Russian tanks from the 1950s and 60s that were given to Syria, and then they were eventually taken over by Daesh. The interesting thing about these tanks is you'll notice that they're both missing half tracks on one side of the tank. That means that these tanks were destroyed the old-fashioned way, which is somebody running up with a bomb, dynamite, what have you, pushing it into the half tracks, blowing up the half tracks so that the rest of the soldiers can get into the tank and kill the tank crew. So that's how these tanks were taken. There's no armor-piercing rounds that you see on these tanks at all, which shows you the type of weapons that the YPG and the YPJ are currently fighting with. Next one. Your tax dollars at work. This is a Hummer from the U.S. Army that made it eventually to the Iraqi army, which Daesh picked up and used in Kobani, and which the Kurds mercifully took out of existence. And then this is just a detail from one of the buildings, but it shows the level of viciousness of this fight. You know, that's like concrete Swiss cheese, right? The politics. So this is a council commune. This is a council commune meeting, and the name of this commune is the Sehid Kawa Sea Commune, and they are located on close to Mishtinor Hill in Kobani. And the man with his finger pointing at the map is named Mr. Shaif or Mr. Shaiko, and he is a member of Tevdem. And Tevdem is an organization made up of representatives of all the political parties in Kobani, interested individuals, people who can assist, as well as, you know, just folks from the community. And Tevdem has a single responsibility in all of Kobani, which is to implement democratic and federalism. That's all they do. They're not a governmental agency. They have no control over the weaponry whatsoever. All they do is implement democratic and federalism. So that's their entire calling. So what is happening in Kobani is that people are beginning to return to the city rather quickly from some of the Turkish refugee camps, probably for good reason. So these communes ideally have around 100 families so that they can be responsive to the needs of the separate families. They're finding that as, you know, people are moving in, that some of these communes are getting quite large and unwieldy. So Tevdem is encouraging communes to think about coming up with new boundaries so that they can maintain the responsiveness to the individuals there. So he's pointing at a map. They're discussing some of the ways that they can potentially divide up the boundaries so that the commune becomes a little bit smaller, and so that other communes can come off of this one commune. There's one interesting thing about this picture. Just real quickly, what is that? There are men and women sitting in a room together. All right? In many homes in Rojava and in Arbil, when you walk into a home, there will be two living rooms. One will be for men, one will be for women. And there's some pretty defined social space around that. But each one of these commune meetings has to be attended by at least 40% women for their decisions to be considered operative. So if it was less than 40% women, they would have to go back and they would have to make a decision again. So that's key. That's the beginning to understand a little bit of how the Rojavans are addressing inequality, particularly as it happens in Middle Eastern cultures. What else? I think that's it. At a secondary level, so just to point out what the communes do, I got a chance after this meeting to talk to the commune members for a while, the council members, and just ask what the council did. And I got a wild range of answers. It was very interesting. One of them is we helped solve a couple of marital issues. Okay, so that's not a usual political thing in the U.S., but I can understand that. They arrange for babysitting. They arrange for people to go to the clinic. They arrange for people to get medicine. They arrange for people to get gasoline so that their cars will run. So they have taken a significant portion of the responsibility associated with what we view as government, and they're localizing it so people can access these services face-to-face. So in a Western liberal democracy, we can say, and think pretty effectively now, that the individual is the fundamental unit, or the fundamental unit of society, right? So in other words, we interact with the governments by virtue of, you know, some of us vote every two or every four years, pay taxes, that type of thing, but we exist as individuals. In the Rojavan system, the most basic unit of the political structure is this unit, the council, the commune. It's not the individual. The individual works within the commune, but the commune goes out and does for the, you know, does the fight that the individual in the Western societies are supposed to do. At the next level, just real quickly, how this looks a little bit further up, the communes will name individuals to the legislature. The legislature is also made up of individuals who are representative of the different parties. The legislature has no ability to actually initiate legislation at this point in time. The legislature exists for the sole purpose of basically legalizing what communes are already doing. So this commune, if they decide to change their boundaries, and I don't know if they need to register it with the legislature or not, but if they do, they'll go to through the legislature, they'll say, oh, we changed our boundaries, we went from street A to street B. And the legislature will get back with a piece of legislation that says, commune, you know, City of Cala C is now, you know, from street A to street B, or what have you. So, I spoke to the legislative manager of the Kobani legislature, and he said, yeah, basically we're a reactive force. We respond to what's going on. We don't initiate legislation. That's not what our responsibility is. That type of thing is done solely within the communes. The communes approach us with ideas that they want developed, and then we basically allow them to go forward with it. And I said, well, you know, what about building roads and things like that? And he said, well, if they need resources, that's something that we can provide. But if they go out and build a road and come to us and say, we built a road, we'll tell them, okay, well, we'll make it legal for you. So it's a very interesting, it's kind of the exact opposite. Also, at this point in time, voting is not going consistently on. So by way of example, the legislature in Kobani Canton is not a voted legislature. It's pretty much appointed through the communes, through the parties, that type of thing. Please.
So they have the ability to grant legality, but they have the ability to
deny. Exactly. No, they don't. In other words, their job is basically to find a way to make it legal. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a responsive, that's their sole response is, okay, so what do you need made legal and then they go forward with? Please.
I don't know sort of what you're getting at, but why is the legislature necessary at all in that case? If it's a matter of like changing the order of the commune, wouldn't it be enough to maybe talk to the commune that's on the other side of Street A? Why does it need to sort of go up a level to another body?
Communication. So that those promulgations can be sent to other communes and communes can see them and can get them. Yeah. It's definitely a communicative body more than anything else, as well as it allows the separate political parties. And I should say that there are a vast plethora of political parties in Rojava right now. Muslim Brotherhood is there. Muslim Brotherhood, the Deputy Prime Minister of Jazeera Canton is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. So they represent a whole bunch of different folks. So it's one of the ways that also the political parties can understand what the communes are doing so that they can get in and talk to them about things that they can potentially provide down the road. So, yeah, it's definitely an excellent question. Communication.
Please. Do the children look
out?
Are they schools?
So there's vastly different situations in Kobani and Jazeera. In Jazeera Canton, there are schools, they're operating. In Kobani, they're in the process of putting those back together. I don't know if you saw her, but in front of the tanks that we just saw were a whole bunch of school benches that had been destroyed by Daesh. One of the things that they had specifically gone and done is destroyed virtually every school that they got their hands on. So that they could stop Western education from occurring. So, yeah. Please. Cell phones do work. Electricity works in most of the cantons except for Kobani and Kobani Canton, where it was effectively destroyed by the bombing. So there are a number of places that do have them, but they are run by large generators, large diesel generators in the street. Food is actually, believe it or not, Rojava is an insanely fertile area. You know, it's right between the Tigris and Euphrates and has a real high water table. And they're starting to discover that virtually anything they throw on the ground, they plant will grow. The Saad government basically had held them to things that they could use, specifically tomatoes, cucumbers, olives, pomegranates, bananas, that type of thing. But now that they don't have to do what the Assad government is telling them to do, they're getting their hands on seeds and planting stuff and finding, wow, there's a lot of stuff to grow here. So it's a pretty interesting time there's a lot of agronomists who are currently there from Iraq, actually. Iran, excuse me, who are working on seeing just exactly what will grow there. So it's really an interesting time for these villages. Sewage does work. It's a rather unique and old system, but it definitely works. Power is still out. I followed around a couple of guys, a couple of French electrical engineers who went from corner to corner in Kobani and who were looking at all the power boxes, and they were saying, wow, this is going to take, you know, the stuff that they need is not expensive, but they can't get it across the border, which is one of the things we'll talk about. The Turkish border, in terms of what's happening in Kobani and Rojava and things like that, is the key to being able to keep this revolution alive right now. I want to go on real quick, but we'll do two more, I promise. Please.
Why was Kobani such a site to be so attacked?
Kobani was a site to be attacked because it was really close to the Turkish border. It was the capital of Kobani Canton. There's also some Arab history to the town as well. It was a perfect target for them. And particularly, remember, they were sweeping from west to east at this point in time from the Mediterranean, and it would have been an ideal, you know, just another town to add to the towns that ISIS had taken. It was, you know, and well-placed, and a good-sized town at that point in time, 115,000, 120,000 people. And then one last one in the back, please.
When you said Evan implements the, like, council system,
yes. Tendem implements democratic and federalism. This council system is a part of democratic and federalism.
Right, that's what I meant. What does it mean to implement democratic?
It means to take the ideas of Abdullah Öcalan from his pamphlet, Democratic and Federalism, and to operationalize them. So in other words, and some of his ideas are pretty general, so they are doing the best that they possibly can, given what he's written. But one of his basic ideas is that Kurdish culture has always been communal, and to be able to take that concept, and this is, you know, There are these council communes all over Rojava, in virtually every town, every village, right? In villages, it's easy, because a commune is basically the village, right? In the cities, it's a little bit more difficult, because now you're dealing with city blocks and all sorts of, like, varied interests and complexities and things like that. So that's where, you know, the implementation of democratic and federalism comes in. But as an anarchist, I would say, well, if that's the case, then we should probably be seeing these things forming spontaneously. This commune formed spontaneously as a result of the siege. And one of the things that these communes did almost immediately with the formation of the siege was begin feeding, clothing, housing members of the commune who had their homes destroyed. Okay? And then they were contacted by the YPG and started doing intelligence gathering from the YPG at night. And finally, this commune found itself under the gun in terms of ISIS, and weapons, Kalashnikovs, were issued to the commune members. Anybody who'd take one and who could pick one up basically was given one. So they fought for their commune. And that's kind of what that looks like. And then the other systems, there are two things if you want to take a look at it. Democratic and Federalism by Öcalan is real good. And then the Constitution of Rojava is called the Social Contract. It's available on the internet. And you can take a look at that, and it'll give you a little bit more definition. Although the depth of service that the commune provides to folks is not implied in what's going on with that document. So you need to kind of read it and think, okay, so what else would they be doing? Right? It's one of those types of things. It's a good comment, though. Yeah, absolutely. So there's the legislature. And then the legislature also doubles as an executive council. The executive council are ministers of defense, ministers of communications, press, that type of thing. The interesting thing is that all those posts, those ministerial posts, are advisory. So by way of example, I met the minister of defense for Kobani Canton. He has no say over what the YPG does or the YPJ does or doesn't do. He solely acts as an advisor to them, provides logistics for them as needed, but he does not define strategic or tactical goals for them at all. Those strategic and tactical goals are primarily the responsibility held within the YPG and the YPJ structure, which we'll talk about that structure a little bit later, but that's interesting. So that's beginning to answer one of our first questions, because the nation state, by definition, has sovereign power. Sovereignty is a real simple concept. A single agency or a single individual controls the monopoly of force over a geographic area. Right? One person, one agency controls force over a geographic area. In the absence of that, you're talking about a non-state structure. And so we know now that the government does not tell YPG and YPJ what to do. Okay? They advise, but they don't tell. Very interesting. No commands come from the governmental structure. That's okay. So that's our first clue as to what's going on. Let's continue. So this is the old Daesh headquarters in Kobani, And I met a really wonderful YPG commander named Rashad, who had a really unusual sense of humor. And we were sitting, and I was watching these flags being painted, and this is a YPG and a YPG tenant. And I said, so what's the story with the flags? And he says, well, it looks like the previous tenants aren't coming back, so we thought we'd redecorate. So I'll talk a little bit about the YPG and the YPJ. So I was hanging out with Rashad in his office one time, and this young soldier, this one young militiaman in the center, came in, and he had been at the hospital and needed a ride out to his outpost. And his outpost was right on the Turkish border, and I was there, and he said, you know, Rashad said, do you guys have a car? And I said, yeah, we do. And he said, would you mind taking this young guy out? And we said, sure, no problem. So we took him out to the Turkish border. So just as a guess, how old do you think that young man is? What do you think?
18.
18. 17. Yeah, he's 20. He joined the YPG at 14 and has been engaged in every major operation, including the rescue of the Yazidis at Shingar. So by any definition of any army or militia in the world, this guy is a combat vet. And he looks like he should be graduating from high school. Yeah. You know, right? So the guy who's standing next to him, to our left, or my left, your right, your left, my left, is the current, the YPG, and I think now we can start talking about the militia. The YPG has no officers. The YPG has no officers. They do not have a command structure that we understand as a command structure. When they go into battle, they will name someone from one of their groups to be a commander. But they, when they're not fighting, everybody's the same. And I mean, everybody's the same. I hung out in a commander's office for 2 days straight. I never saw a single salute. I never saw anybody jump up on their feet when he entered the room. Didn't see any piece of the classic discipline that you'd expect from an army. But I saw the type of loyalty that you'd expect from a militia. So this young man on the side, that's true for everything but at the Turkish border. And at the Turkish border, the understanding is, if the Turks push over this border, we're not going to have time to sit and elect a leader. So we need to have a leader pretty much pro tem the entire time, so that if the Turks do push past the border, we're going to be able to take care of them. So this young man, he's 24 years old, standing next to the center guy, is the current leader of that team. Just real quickly in terms of how it's organized, the most basic organization is a team which is 6 to 10 fighters. After a team, two teams are a suite, which is 12 to 20 fighters. Two suites becomes a block, which is, 24 to 40 fighters. And then a block becomes a company, and the company is two blocks. So they also have larger units, which basically function as commandos, and those are up to 400 soldiers, sometimes 600, depending on where they're at, 400 militia people. So the only standing officers in any of the YPG at any given point in time are regional commanders, and the regional commanders serve in their command post for 6 months. And after that, they're relieved of that command, and they can never go back to hold that command again. Why? What has Ocalan read? He's read about the French Revolution, hasn't he? He's like, wow, military commanders who have personal relationships with their troops have a tendency to gain counter-revolutionary forces. He's not allowing that. Crazy like a fox. It's exactly what you want to do. Give somebody who knows how to command for a while, but don't let them command the same men over and over again, or the same women over and over again. It's a danger. So that in and of itself tells you that there's some serious thought going on to the Rajava Revolution. So let's take a look at this next one. I just want to show, regardless of how young the young militiaman was that we took to the border, you can tell that this guy's a lot younger. Now, he told me he was 16, which I totally didn't believe. He had just crossed over from either Aleppo or Damascus, where one member of his family, I believe, was killed, and he came over to fight with the YPG. So this is a guy who walked across ISIS lines to be able to join the YPG and participate in the war. You'll see the bullet holes on the building. So at night, when they have nothing to do, the Turks will shoot at the YPG, and the YPG will shoot at the Turks. That's kind of the thing that they do to each other. So, and obviously, for those of you who have been watching the news, some of these areas have become more and more hotly contested over time, with real artillery duels and people, you know, dying and that type of thing, as opposed to just a few gunshots being shot over the border. So, the Turks are taking more and more interest in trying to eliminate Rojava. Okay. Can I get the next one? This is an essayish. This gentleman is an essayish. And you can see it spelled up in the corner there, the A-S-A-Y-S. And he stopped our car. He's taken a quick look inside. He's decided that we are not hostile and is now waving us on. And then the minute he sees that I'm a Westerner, he'll stop and he'll ask a few questions and that type of thing. So, you know, I get questioned all the time. It's like, you always say that you felt safer in Rojava than you do in the U.S. It's like, yeah, because in the U.S. I'm terrified of cops. You know, I don't like being stopped. Here, every time I saw an Assayas checkpoint, I felt good. It's like, oh, I'm glad these guys are out here. You know, thank you very much. So, and they were actually friendly and open, you know, which not a definition of most police forces I'm aware of. And then the next one. This is on top of the media center in Amuda. And this is a young essayish who I'm sitting next to. And he and I got a chance to talk a little bit. He was actually a pretty interesting character. The reality of this picture is I always wanted a picture with a 50 caliber submachine gun. So. And I finally got one. And then this Amuda, the Jazeera legislature is in the next building over. So his responsibility is not just for the media center, but for protecting the legislature as well. Okay. Next one? Yeah. You can't see this one very well. It's pretty dark. This is the T.S. Samal Commando, which is located in Jazeera. They were stationed in Jazeera when I was there. These guys are much older than the folks you just saw. They'll be 35, 40, 45, even 50. A lot of these guys have been infiltrated over the border from Turkey. So these are real combat vets who've been fighting the Turkish government for probably a decade or two. Okay, and their commander is the same thing. He started fighting the Turks probably in 85 or 86, so just after the shooting war began between the Kurds and the Turks. And so one of the questions that the U.S. military has consistently asked is, how did the YPG get this stuff up and running so rapidly? And it's like, well, first of all, they were formed in 2002, so there's that. And second is they brought in real seasoned commanders and soldiers directly across the border from Turkey. It's not like this was a military or a militia that was constructed out of thin air. This experience that they gained fighting the Turks, then they turned against, well, actually they became more self-defense for a while, and then with ISIS they were forced to fight back. So, and then the next picture is this gentleman who's rather heavy set. This is his Kalashnikov, and he wanted me to make sure that I took a picture of that. And he said, that bullet welded on the end of my gun reminds me to always save just one bullet. Always save just one bullet for me, in case I ever get captured. And then finally, can we go a couple of slides forward? One more? All right. This is June 25th of 2015. About 100 Daesh fighters dressed as Assayish and YPG soldiers crossed the Turkish border with three cars that were loaded with dynamite. They exploded those cars, and then they went door to door, literally knocking on doors, and pulling families out and slaughtering them in the street. 233 civilians lost their lives this way. And as an example of the horrendousness of this massacre, there were very few Latinized gravestones, but this was one of them. So this young person, Jemgen Agheri, was born May 10th, 2014, and likely died June 25th, 2015. So a 14-month-old toddler shot dead. So after this happened in Kobani, and then now we can go back to the HPC, the picture of the gentleman with the HPC. It was recognized that they now need another militia. And this is a very interesting militia for us as anarchists, because this militia is tied directly to the communes, the councils. Each council commune was, the way that this militia came into being was a lot of the communes had already had militia people associated with them. So in other words, people were given Kalashnikovs by the YPG, they kept the Kalashnikovs, and they were using them to patrol the streets. The militias approached the legislature and said, listen, we've got this militia up and running. Can you guys, like, give us a name and maybe get us some training and give us some tasking to do so that we can keep these people busy? And the legislature came back and said, sure, we'll give you a name. You know, it's the HBC, the self-defense units. The uniform is a brown vest. The training is about 17 days long. It includes half of it is YPG and YPJ weapons training. Half of it is ideological stuff that's provided by TEBDEM folks. And so now these individuals are beginning to work in the community. Now these people, again, we talked about who's responsible for giving orders and things like that. You're looking at somebody whose responsibility, their orders come directly from their commune council. It comes from no other place. Okay? So that's, again, that's interesting for us. Because over and over again, we've seen at the level of military laws of a revolution, the loss because there were no localized militias that were capable of fighting back when a counter-revolution occurred. This is, again, Ocalan, crazy as a fox, right? And these are new. The training for these HBCs began in Jezira Canton in March of 2015, and they began in Kobani a little bit later. Kobani really got caught because they realized that with the June 25th massacre, if they had had more HBC folks, that they would have been able to maybe do a little bit more damage to the 100 Daesh fighters that came across the border. So, and then taking a look at another group of HPC, just some folks. The woman in the green all the way over on our left is, or actually my left, your right, is an Asayish officer, or an Asayish, and then all the other folks here are folks have been trained in our HBC militia members. So, please.
Are the communes regional or ideological, or how are
they grouped? They're geographic. They're basically a commune ideally is between 50 and 100 families. And that's based actually on the communal structure of the agricultural villages. Right. So that's where they take it from. That's kind of the ideal, is to have them be that size so that they're responsive. Okay, so next slide. This is, martyrs are huge in Kurdish culture. And, you know, here, anarchists have their own martyrs, you know, Haymarket, that type of thing, Sakon Benzeti. There are thousands of martyrs in the Kurdish resistance culture. And there are pictures of them all over everywhere. Offices, houses, stores, streets, street corners, that type of thing. They are everywhere. And they usually list the name of the individual, which militia they fought with, that type of thing. So they function as a real important piece of resistance culture. It was one thing that as who I am, and you know, with my upbringing, I didn't get very well, but I had a TEBDEM guy explain, you know, each one of those martyrs will produce 30 or 40 recruits for the YPG and the YPJ. They bring people in, they motivate people to fight. So, very interesting. And this is the martyr cemetery in Kobani. These are individuals who were killed during the siege. There's about 1,800, 2,000 bodies here. And they believe there's probably about another 1,000 buried under the rubble. Now, the Kurds have a real serious sense of vengeance, and they took the Daesh fighters and dragged them right up next to the Turkish border and burned them on days where the wind was blowing across the border. Right? Because they wanted to make sure that they were giving them back to Turkey, because that's where they came from. That was kind of interesting. And the next one. Yep, one more. Just a little girl who was out with her family at the cemetery. And one more. Just kind of a note on Kurdish culture. So the translator that I worked with was named Mohammed, and we were out in the field near Hasaka one night real late, and we got in early in the morning, and we were hungry, and nothing was open. So he said, let me call my mom, and she'll cook some food for us. So he called his mom, and they said, come on over. So they laid this wonderful spread out for us, and he's in the back there pouring tea. And it was just really amazing. So this is kind of what a traditional Kurdish breakfast is, and I never realized it before, but olives are an amazing breakfast food. Okay, so something to think about. Not just good with martinis, good for breakfast. And then there was one other thing that I really liked. You can't see them very well here, but can you see the one bowl with the red, kind of the chili powder in it? Right next to it, on the other side of it, is, for all intents and purposes, Kurdish chili rellenos. They were chilies that had spices and cheese in them that had been preserved in oil. And I stuck these all the way across 4 international borders so I could have some for breakfast. Because I told, Muhammad that his mom's peppers were amazing, so they were. Anyway, and the next slide. This is Muhammad, and this is his dad, and this is his brother. The reason I show him is because his family is not revolutionary at all. This is not a family that has YPG and YPJ flags. This is not a family that has a picture of Öcalan in the home, that type of thing. And yet, Muhammad's real name, the name that he was given by his family, is Ajit. And Ajit was the very first fighter who fired the very first bullet in 1984, probably one of the most famous martyrs in the PKK. Now, he had to change his name because he kept getting beat up at school for having that name. And so his name is now Muhammad. But, the assumption is from his family and everyone is that with the success of the revolution, that his name will become Ajit. That's what he tells me. I just asked him, I said, what do you really want? He says, I want to be called Ajit. So, and then the next slide. This is Malatesta. Malatesta is an incredibly scrappy cat at the only hotel in Kobani. And he drives the hotel staff to distraction, but never leaves them alone. And he's real tiny, as you can tell. Definitely a Malatesta type of character. So I thought I'd include him to show that it was me paying my cat tax. And then, just to conclude this piece of the presentation, here's my email address, and then the dispatches. There are copies in the back, hard copies in the back. And then if you want to see the ones on the website at Modern Slavery and Cal Press, they're there with some of the photos that we've seen, as well as some other photos, that type of thing. So, and I'll answer any email if people have questions, that type of thing. I'd be more than happy to. Yes. Absolutely. So just to wrap up, what is the final impression of what's going on in Rojava? And there's a couple of things I think that are really important for us as anarchists. First of all, for a political idea that has existed, pretty much in its full form, at least since the 1750s or so, we always get the comment back, it could never work. It's a non-functional idea because of the way that people are. And we now have the ability to say, you know what, that's not true. Because we have an example of an anarchist revolution that's actually working and appears to be working pretty well. Not only can it defend itself, but it appears to, as long as we can get material to it, it will probably be able to rebuild itself too. And the other piece is that I always thought a revolution would have something a lot more to do with what was happening at the level of the heart as opposed to the head. And I was deeply confirmed in that because I'll put it real simply. Revolutions drag you forward by the heart, by the balls, by the ovaries. It's unavoidable. And it was an amazing experience. People ask me, what can we do? And the reality of the situation is to give money right now to Rojava is probably not the best thing to be able to do. Right now, the best thing that we can do is to try to open that border from Turkey. Because that's the real problem. That if that border was open, you saw the pictures of Kobani. That's a year after the siege, and very little has been done. And very little has been done in terms of building infrastructure, electricity, sewage, that type of thing. If they could get stuff across the border, either through Turkey or through the Iraq, the KRG, that would be a huge step in the right direction. So anything that you folks can do. And I know you anarchists can do a lot. anything you folks can do to be able to facilitate that process, not begging, I'm not a person who begs anyone, but, doing the best to be able to direct the Turks to please pay attention to what they're doing at that border, that would be a great thing. And then after that, if people are interested at this stage of the game to go over, Believe it or not, they need you. The Rojavans love having people come in. They really want individuals to come, and they're looking for anybody, people who have technical advice, people who are technical experts, electrical engineers, construction engineers, artists, writers, that type of thing. They want everybody to come over. How do I get over that way? You get onto the website called the Rojava Plan, okay? And they can give you a hand in terms of being able to get you over there. Maybe they'll even get you a journalist pass, you know, press card. So that's, you know, other than Q&A, are there any questions? Well, that's the presentation. Thanks for coming out. Before I begin the quick Q&A, I should say one thing, is that I'm not here to basically, I see myself in this position as more as a tabula rasa, somebody who can give you what I've seen. I may even be able to give you some of my conclusions, but people have asked me, well, you know, are you really defending what's going on in Rojava? I said, I don't really see that as my place. I want you people to see it through my eyes and for you to come to decisions about whether to support or not support what's going on there on the basis of at least some added information. And we all know that the information we were getting about Rojava prior to this was pretty crappy. You know, most of us, had anybody heard of TevDem prior to, you know, me coming back? I hadn't. Until I got over there, and everybody's like, oh yeah, TevDem's the group you want to talk to. They're the ones who are doing these implementations and putting power back in the communities. Real unique. Real unique. So, let's get started. Please.
You didn't get to talk about women very much.
I didn't. Actually, let's talk a little bit about women. Let's talk about the ecology stuff. So, the empowerment of women is huge with both PKK and PYD, and again, this comes from some of Bookchin's stuff. It also comes from a lot of stuff in Middle Eastern culture, and I keep telling the same story, but it's a really good story. So one of the things that we see with the YPG and the YPJ is they're beginning to function as real schools for the revolution. So the first thing that they've done is they've built a real standardized barracks for mixed companies. So a mixed company is a company, YPG and YPJ. They've got a women's barracks on one side, a men's barracks on the other side, and then a corridor between, which has meeting rooms and kitchens and things like that. So these are beginning to, people, men and women are beginning to interact in ways that they would never have interacted in traditional society. By way of example, right now, you know, or prior to the revolution, I may have lived next door to somebody who's my same age, you know, if I'm a young person, for my entire life and maybe only seen her 30 or 40 times, right? I mean, because women are pretty much indoors doing cooking, that type of thing. Men are out with dad doing whatever, or men out with dad doing working, that type of thing. So we're beginning to see a lot of interaction between men and women. They go on patrols together, they work together in these mixed companies. Women will make food one night, men will make food the next night, which is another key thing too, which is making food. And this is where we kind of get into the story. So the Yazidis, prior to the rescue from Mount Shingar, were relatively pacifist. The Yazidi religion is an incredibly old religion, probably associated with Zoroastrianism, you know, predates Christianity, probably at the same level of age, Judaism, that type of thing. So, and extremely conservative as a religion, extremely conservative. Like, so conservative that, you know, knives that are used in the kitchen by women to cut food should never be touched by men. Right? That level of cultural definition of social space and social implements. So I talked to a young Yazidi, YPG member, and with the rescue, a lot of younger men had decided they wanted to join the YPG, and I think the Yazidis basically came to a decision as a religious group that was probably a good idea. Anyway, this Yazidi, you know, he did his 45 days of training, he did a month in the field doing, you know, his duties, and then, you know, one thing that he was forced, he cooked these meals. And he was like, it was really tough because, you know, it's like, this is not part of my culture at all. And so, you know, I had to learn how to cook and kind of, that was one of the hardest things that he did. And I said, well, what was the effect? And he said, well, I went home, they get 4 days off every month, the YPG, single YPG soldiers. I had 4 days off at the end of the month, and I went home, and I said, what was that like? And he says, I spent all 4 days apologizing to my mother and helping to make dinner. Right? So as a revolutionary, what's my first thought? What is this person going to be like in 20 years? Right? What is this level of opening up, this culture, going to look like in 20 years? That's important, you know. So that's just an example. The other issue is one of ecology. And as we said before, Kobani at the level of ecology is a nightmare. Okay? Just think of what's buried in the ground in Kobani other than dead bodies. You know, American munitions were used, so we know there's depleted uranium there, right? Exploded and unexploded ordnance and explosive devices. Tons of lead, you know, probably unsheathed from the bullets. And this is all buried beneath the ground, and it's a month's worth of this stuff. So I was speaking to the defense minister in Kobani Canton. I said, so what do you think you're going to do? And he said, you know, I can't wait for this war to be over so that I can turn militia people into environmental engineers. And we can begin to understand just exactly the damage that was done to Kobani as a result of this battle. So there's obviously, they don't have the resources for it now, but they're very interested in it. Additionally, you know, for those of you who come from areas where there's oil, and Northern Colorado has its share, when oil wells are operating, they will pool oil at the very top by virtue of the sucking the oil out of the ground. And the Assad regime, not known for their environmental, you know, emphasis, just let it pool and then built spillways down into huge ponds that they had built with that are not lined. So as you're driving across Kobani, you'll see these huge oil ponds. Now that's oil that's seeping down into groundwater. God knows where it's going. So the Kurds immediately recognize that one of the things they're going to have to do is to line those spillways. And then what they want to do is they want to build concrete sarcophagi to hold the pooled oil and then either pull the oil out and use it or destroy it. So they're already thinking ahead to be able to how to deal with some of the most basic ecological problems that they've got in Rojava. And it's, again, it's just the beginning process. And what's really needed is resources. And again, the problem they have right now is that they don't even know how deep the ecological damage is because they can't bring over environmental engineers to be able to take a look at some of the you know, the damage to the soil, the water, that type of thing. So, very interesting. So there's that. Please. Sure.
And maybe climate change as an effect, or you know, what are the people ground in Syria? What do they talk about?
Sure. Rojava, it's a good point. Rojava lives in her villages. Okay, so there's a couple big cities, 3 million people, but probably 2.5 million people are living in small villages, and there are thousands of them. You know, all over. And some of these villages, there's a lot of communal ownership of the land that surrounds these villages. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at Google Earth and you take a look at Rojava, you will see that a lot of these fields radiate out like rays of the sun from each one of the villages. And some of these fields are immense. So I come from Northern Colorado, and there's a field that I looked at from Google Earth, which is about 2 miles wide and about 23 miles long. So, coming from Northern Colorado, that tells me two things about this field. One, this is a field that's never been irrigated, because I don't need to. And the other one is, this is a field that indicates that there's some major communal work being done to be able to harvest it. And when I got there, I saw the communal harvesting. When I was there, the growing season was effectively over. They were just in the process of harvesting these really tiny little watermelons, and then they were getting ready to harvest cotton. But it wasn't just men or just women who were out in the field. It was families, that type of thing, and all from the surrounding villages. So there's a communal thing. And, the agriculture, again, these are type of things where they have been selling these crops for, you know, centuries, and then taking the money and dividing it up between the families. So this is what Ocalan, when he talks about communalism, this is what he's building the backbone of his revolution on, which are structures that have basically been in existence for survival, you know, for you know, how long, 1,000 years maybe. I mean, it's brilliant. You know, it's stunningly brilliant. And then in terms of, you know, any lost agriculture as a result of global warming, I never talked to anybody who told me that they were having problems with their agriculture at all. If anything, right now it's kind of boom time because they're beginning to discover that they can, I mean, they're starting to grow grain again. And they haven't been able to grow grain because it's not been one of the things that they've been allowed to grow. So wheat, you know, some of the triticale, that type of thing, they're looking to produce, as well as barley. So yeah, it's a real exciting time. But again, coming at it from a revolutionary sense, it's exactly what you hope for. People who are effectively in a self-sustaining type of mode at the level of food, agriculture, growth, that type of thing, perfect, right? I don't need to import anything to keep folks alive. That's great. That's really good news. So, yeah, excellent. Please.
Can you speak to, like, what commerce is like, the economy,
Sure. The economy right now, the current currency that they're using is the Syrian pound, which, as you can imagine, as a currency, is, you know, pretty much, it's been effectively devalued, so it's worth something in Rojava, but not much anyplace else. In Kamishli, there are still merchants who are capable of getting things across the Turkish border. Most of the stuff that comes in the Kurdish areas, and again, we haven't really talked about the oppression of the Kurds under Assad. We probably should. And Kamishli is a painful reminder of that. In Kamishli, when you're in a Syrian area of town, it's really nice. The streets are full of banks and offices and airline offices and that type of thing. When you're in the Kurdish areas, none of those things are there. Okay? Because they were not allowed to go there. They were not allowed to be in Kurdish areas of Kamishli. So a lot of the materials that make it into the Kurdish economy, and this is still an economy, unfortunately, that's going on because of the Syrian thing, are things that are basically being sold to the Kurds through the Syrians, because the Syrians can get them across the border. The Kurds never could. So that border, that one border between Kamishli and Turkey is open because it's a border that effectively is backed up against Syria. Some of the materials are coming in from the Iraqi regional government, or the Kurdish regional government. I should say, too, you know, I kind of trash the Kurdish regional government, and I don't feel bad about that, but the folks in the Kurdish region, I'll tell you the one story that really affected me. So I was in my hotel, I was in Arbil, I was trying to get to Feshabur, and I couldn't find anybody who would give me a lift, so I talked to the concierge, and I stayed in a pretty nice hotel. I talked to the concierge, and I said, I need to get to Feshabur. And he says, oh, I know where you're going. And I said, can you help me? He says, I will help you, but only if you come back to this hotel when you're done and tell us what's happening there. Right? And I said, I promise. The guy picked me up at 8 a.m. that next morning, took me to the border, probably 120 miles for free. For free. And set me off. He says, if you have a problem, I'll take you back. You know, I said, if I have to swim, I'm going to get across the Tigris. So, and then I went back, after I was done, 10 days later, and sat with almost probably half the hotel staff, including like the managers, and talked a little bit about what I saw there. And I asked, what are you guys' interests? And every hand went up when I said, people had relatives in Rojava. You know, they were interested in hearing what was going on. So, what was the question?
About, like, how people got things for themselves.
What was that?
How people...
The commerce. So there is commerce coming through from the KRG. You see across the border, you see, you know, trucks, that type of thing. And that's traditional commerce. One of the things that they're trying to figure out in Rojava is now what to do about private property. The battle is easier in Kobani, because in Kobani there's not much private property left. And so private property based on use is beginning to be seen as how property should be held. So private property is not based on purchase or deed, but use. So if you and I decide, let's put in a convenience store on the corner of Smith and Wesson in Kobani, right? So we go in, we take over the store, or, you know, the store is empty. We build the store, we put our stuff in it, we're there for 5 years. We're basically, you know, we're taking care of the store and doing the upkeep ourselves. We're done with it. You know, we sell out all our goods and merchandise and leave. That store belongs to us as long as we're there and using it. And when we stop using it, it ceases to belong to us. That is likely what some of the private property things will look like in Rojava. It's a concept that Ocalan has been playing with for a long time. Because he doesn't want to, you know, you don't want huge disruptions, but then you also, you know, and you think about kind of who that's going to affect. Well, if I have four separate apartments in four separate cities, I lose three of those and one of those becomes mine because I can only use one at a time, right? So commerce is going to be something different, and they're also going to have to come up with their own currency. That's clear if the free democratic Syria happens. In that instance, I think that Rojava will be able to protect itself and maintain itself as an autonomous region. How it's going, how the actual economy is going to work, that's something I think the Tevdem and, you know, some of the economists are looking at and trying to figure out. A lot of the traditional communal stuff is going to stay the same. But the merchant, The merchant stuff in the towns is going to be very different. And I should also say, this is not an industrialized society at all. So one of the things that you do not hear from Ted Dem are the classic leftist, bourgeoisie, proletariat, class struggle type of stuff. That's not the language they speak. And that's not the revolution that they're having. Okay? So that's very interesting. I hope that paints a little bit of the picture.
Others?
Please. Yeah, I can guarantee you they're not using any pesticides or any chemicals at all because they can't afford it.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, they're using the classic dump,
yeah.
Right? Wherever they can get it from. So, but I think that this harks back to, you know, when you read Democratic Confederalism in a bubble, like when you're living in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania, and you read this, you don't get the fact that the guy is riffing on a whole bunch of structures that are already present in Kurdish society. He is just basically, you know, enumerating different ways that they can interact and become revolutionary, innovative institutions. When you get on the ground in Rojava and you see what's going on, it's like, oh my God, he's not talking about coming up with something new. He's talking about basically allowing innovations in things that are incredibly old, which is really fascinating. And I think that that kind of harks to the fact that, I mean, these are cultural forms that have been utilized effectively, and economic forms that have been utilized for, you know, centuries. And I think that the tying it to land, I mean, it's happenstance that Rojava is an agricultural community. But that may allow for its longevity as well. In other words, if it wasn't, if it was more every third city is a Kemishli, it may look very different and they may get sucked back into industrial civilization or, you know, some type of neoliberal, neoglobal nightmare, that type of thing. And that may happen as well. Like, you know, for those of us who've been following Rojava over the course of the past two or three weeks or so, you know, the U.S. definitely wants a piece of Rojava. There's no doubt about it. They're talking about putting a new base in for 1,500 individuals, 1,500 U.S. Army members. And so the struggle, the fight isn't over. The key here is that the Kurds have known that was going to happen. And they have definitely done everything they possibly can to be able to marginalize as much as possible any influence that the U.S. would have at the level of politics in Rojava, which is really smart. So, what else? Yes? Did I encounter any foreign volunteers? Yes. So I'm getting chicken in Kobani because I'm sick of what they're serving in my hotel. And I'm standing there, and all of a sudden I'm surrounded by these incredibly tall guys. And one guy, like, hits my shoulder with his finger, and he says, "You're an American." I'm saying, "Yep." And he says, "Yeah, so are we." So there were four guys there. Three of them were members of the Special Forces. And the reality of a lot of the foreign fighters, like not the ones that we get through, you know, the anarchist websites, is a lot of them are kind of right-wing, I want to kill as many, you know, Daesh terrorists as I humanly can. And these guys were all ex-special forces. They were scary, looking, that type of thing. One of them was really interesting to me, though. He was a young man from Virginia, and he'd come over to basically do the right wing, kill as many, you know, Arab fighters as he possibly could. And in the middle of it, he all of a sudden, he and I were talking, he says, you know, I realized that there was a revolution going on there. And then he kind of whispers to me, you realize that they think that, you know, that they don't think that voting is democracy? And I said, does that bother you? And he says, no, I think it may be right. So he kind of, you know, and he's telling me this in this really slow Virginia beach drawl. I was like, oh, my God. So, you know, here's, you know, it's almost like some bad 1960s comedy. I came to fight the Arabs, and I got dragged into a revolution. You know, it's like some Broadway show. But that's exactly what happened to this guy. Since I've been back, I received a number of communications from parents of some of the foreign fighters to see if they've heard, if I met them or that type of thing. So I've kind of been back and forth with the foreign fighters. Almost everybody that I spoke to, I mean, they're probably 2,000 to 3,000. Most of them are ex-military in some way, shape, manner, or form. Some are ideological. There's the DH party in Turkey. There's a number of kind of Trotsky individuals who are involved with it. So it's kind of an interesting group. It's kind of an interesting mix. I said, you know, because of course these guys are scary. So I was like, you guys are really scary. So who's the scariest foreign fighters you've got? And they were just like, oh, the French Foreign Legion guys, who are like all ex-French Foreign Legion, who go around with like these skull masks and stuff. And they keep them away from everybody else and, you know, throw food over the fence and stuff. It was pretty funny. You know, so there are a bunch of foreign fighters over there. And when a foreign fighter is killed, it's a big deal with the YPG and the YPJ. They make sure that people understand that and know it. You know, they're not ashamed that foreigners are fighting, you know, in their other hometown, you know, on their home turf. It's pretty amazing. What else? Please. Restorative justice is underway right now. There are only 400 people incarcerated out of 3 million in Rojava. And those 400 are basically, they've been identified. They don't convict because there are no operating tribunals going on. And it is doubtful that they will do anything further in terms of the tribunal process. They're still trying to figure out what to do. What they really want to do is to send them across the border and never see them again. Yeah, so, the Amnesty International stuff, there's been some interesting responses to that. So, I can't remember the website. There's a website now. You can see it on our anarchism on Reddit that kind of is responding to some of the issues around some of the criminal, or the justice stuff. It's the real problem I see with it is it fails to understand on what's happening in Rojava, where, you know, Kurds and Arabs have been living with each other for, you know, centuries. Actually, let's play a song. One of the things I really like about what's going on in Rojava is that it's happening at the cultural level too. So there's a sister organization to Tevdem called Tevchand, which is all about implementing a culture, right, and regaining Kurdish culture. So they pay musicians, they pay painters to go out into the field, and they also run painting classes and that type of thing. They had just done a really wonderful thing. They had done movies for kids in Kobani and in Kamishli, and the movie that they showed was The Kid by Charlie Chaplin. So that was pretty cool. So there's a lot of interesting cultural stuff. They just finished two films that they described to me as well. They're kind of Kurdish Eisenstein. You know, it's all about the revolution. I said, so basically propaganda. They said, yes, absolutely, but it's good propaganda. I said, well, what else are you doing? And they said, well, we're thinking of doing a revolutionary soap opera because we like the form. And I used to work in Vietnam, and the most popular soap opera still in Vietnam today is a soap opera that was shot in the 60s, and it was called Going South to Kill Americans, right? So it was like a popular soap opera. And you can still watch it today on Vietnamese TV. So when they told me that, I told them about this Vietnamese soap opera, and they were like writing it down. It's like, oh yeah, you can definitely get things off the internet, you know, from that soap opera. It's great. So let me play a tune for you. The interesting thing about this tune is, see if we can get the words up for you. Is it's on the iTunes, and then.
بادر بالانتساب إلى قوات اليابقية. الله حيّد يحمي الشعب هو اليابقية. الله حيّد يحمي الشعب هو اليابقية. طال العزة والكرامة هو اليابقية. كل الفخر والشهامة هو اليابقية. حيّ اليابقية. حيّ اليابقية. حيّ اليابقية. حيّ اليابقية. الله حيّ يحمي الشعب هو اليابقية. الله حيّ يحمي الشعب هو اليابقية. شباب الكرد والعرب والمسيح أقوى مع قوى اليابقية نحمي بالقوة. شباب الكرد والعرب والمسيح أقوى مع قوى اليابقية نحمي بالقوة. نحمي أرض الوطن نزرع به الأمل. نحمي أرض الوطن نزرع به الأمل. الله حيّ يحمي الشعب هو اليابقية. الله حيّ يحمي الشعب هو اليابقية. داحية سلام وحب داحية من القلب. يابقية يسهر ما ينام يسهر يحمي الشعب. داحية سلام وحب داحية من القلب. يابقية يسهر ما ينام يسهر يحمي الشعب. يبدي بروح الشعب يبدي بعمر الشعب. يبدي بروح الشعب يبدي بعمر الشعب. الله حيّ يحمي الشعب هو اليابقية. الله حيّ يحمي الشعب هو اليابقية. الله حيّ يحمي الشعب هو اليابقية. الله حيّ يحمي الشعب هو اليابقية.
So that's just one example. And there are thousands of songs about the YPG, about Ocalan, about the revolution. So it's its own cultural identity. And the one that you just heard, that's an Arab tune, and that's Arab that's being sung. So this is a tune encouraging Arab young men to join the YPG, which I think is fascinating. So, and the one, the T.S. Samal, the one commando that we saw, which is kind of a meat grinder commando, those are the guys they throw in when things are going wrong. Half that commando is made up of Arab militia people, Arab militiamen. So very interesting. I want to give you another flavor. Let's get onto the VLC file. Yeah, there we go. This is a protest, or actually a ceremony where they passed the bodies of 18 fighters from who've been killed in the siege of Kobani. They were giving them back to the Jazeera Canton to be buried in Jazeera Canton. And this is the very end of it. You'll hear the folks chant, and then you'll see the Tebdem representatives, the men, kiss each other, and that will be the end of the ceremony. So let's look. Let's look. Would you mind translating those chants?
Basically, they were saying martyrs, they never die.
Martyrs are eternal, right? Excellent. I thought so. Yeah, the martyrs are eternal is a classic one. Yeah. What is it? Sahid Mahideen or something like that? Sahid?
Nama.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, anyway, good. Thank you very much. So that gives you a feel for at least one of the small demonstrations on the street. This is, again, this is part of the martyr culture, which is the institution that we're at is basically for the families of martyrs. It's to keep them, you know, to be there for them when they need help and support, that type of thing, as well as to support memories of the fighters being maintained. And so a lot of these families will write down the life stories of the martyrs, and then they will be put into magazines. Like YPG and YPJ have at least two or three magazines a month come out, and these magazines are full of the lives of the martyrs. So, what else do you have? Please.
Are they just defining martyrs as people who died in
battle? Martyrs, again, the derivation, at least from what I got from Tevden, is fallen hero, but because martyr also fits into that, it's definitely more secular than, say, like an ISIS type of, you know, suicide bomber, so, yeah. In the back, please.
Speak up.
As someone who is very much what do you disagree with about the official U.S. reports coming out, specifically in regard to sort of cult of
Yeah, well, it's exactly the type of thing you'd expect. I mean, obviously, this is coming from the top end of, you know, I mean, these are the really smart guys who, you know, are working in the CIA and are feeding materials to, you know, you cannot see a New York Times. You know, I initially thought, well, we'll see what I saw. You know, there are a lot of pictures of Ocalan that you see around, but I never really heard, you know, I mean, he's kind of seen as like this, almost like a Ho Chi Minh, like someone who's helped design this really great society, but you don't really see a lot of the classic hero worship type of stuff. In other words, I didn't see a single statue of Ocalan. I saw a lot of pictures, and people would carry pictures around, and sometimes pictures in people's homes, but the level of worship that is implied, I never really experienced or encountered. And also, it's kind of hard to take it from the U.S. government, considering they're probably responsible for him being jailed for the rest of his life. You know, so, and again, that's the other thing, too, as an anarchist, it's like, wow, what if this guy gets released? It's like, well, there's very little reality that's ever going to happen. So, it's the type of thing where the way that the Kurds interact with their history is sometimes through individuals, and this is clearly an individual who they're in many ways already interacting with history about, particularly, I mean, from 1984 with the beginning of the battle. So it's exactly the type of thing you'd expect from, you know, so that they can get their hooks into the ideas that are going beyond Rojava, because they're not talking about the substance of what's going on. I was really surprised with the New York Times articles that just came out. The one name I expected to see, because they're the one people who are kind of pulling the strings right now, Tevdem, were not mentioned at all. They mentioned PYD. And the PYD, if you're on the ground in Rojava, is effectively being sidelined and kind of kept to be kind of an ideological place where they, you know, they keep party militants and things like that. But they're certainly not the people who are pulling the strings in the communes and that type of thing anymore. I mean, it's not happening. And everybody, I mean, to meet the head of Tevdem was like a big deal. To meet the head of the PYD was easy. You know, so it kind of told me that one guy was real busy and the other guy was looking for interviews. Right? So, at least that was my sense. So, very interesting. Yeah. We'll see where they take it next. I'm sure the martyr stuff probably has thrown them off, and they're trying to craft some ideas around that one. So it's interesting that they don't mention the anti-capitalism, that they don't really mention some of the political forms either. It's hinted at, and even Murray Bookchin has mentioned, but there's no explication of exactly what's going on there. It's kind of like, well, it's what you expect in the New York Times. Yeah. There's nothing more inaccurate or wrong, you know, than yesterday's New York Times, with the exception of today's. So, what else? Please.
Do you have a sense of what the relationship between Rojava and the PKK or the situation in Turkey?
It's a real difficult question. Well, my first 20 minutes in Rojava were like this. They brought me into this one guy's office. He got me my press pass. And he said, so there's two things I need to tell you. One is that the PYD and the PKK have nothing to do with each other. My first thought was, I didn't ask about that. You know, so the PYD and the PKK obviously have a great deal to do with each other. And there is a lot of back and forth between the two. And it is undoubted that much of the PYD and the decisions that are being made are actually being made on the other side of the border in Turkey and then are being transferred across. So there is a significant amount of relationship, which I think is fine, because there is a significant amount of relationship at the level of politics between what's happening in Rojava and what's happening in Turkey. So the very idea that those things are being coordinated is a good thing. PKK scares people because it's, you know, this terrorist organization, right, which, you know, the U.S. naming a terrorist organization is a lot like the Nazis naming an anti-Semite. You know, it makes no sense to me. So I just, you know, it's the type of thing where I think that they were worried about, and they also, you know, they didn't know me, but, you know, gee, it's a terrorist organization, so it just jumped the stage in my book, right? Not a big deal. So there's a great deal of crossing over. And for most people, it's not a problem, given what the PKK has done and given the fact that, I mean, PKK has been open to negotiations. I mean, not acting very terrorist recently at all. As a matter of fact, really trying to find some accommodation with the Turkish state. And with Erdogan, that accommodation is just not available to them. So, good question. Please. You have a question?
What about those two tanks that you showed?
Yes.
When did they get taken out of service? What was the date of the attack on those tanks?
It would have been, if it was the siege of Kobani, which I assume it was because it's sitting right outside of the Kobani YPG headquarters, it would have been, what was that, October to the first week of November of 2014. So 13 months ago, those tanks would have been destroyed.
So the Russians were coming in to attack?
No, those were Russian tanks that were given to the Syrians.
Oh.
They were part of the Assyrian armory, and then when Daesh took over the Syrian arms depots, they got their hands on those tanks. Yeah, same thing with the Humvee was American, given to the Iraqis, and then when they took over an Iraqi arms depot, they took that Humvee as well. So second and third hand weapons. Please. That's the Rojava plan. That's the Rojava plan, yeah.
That's the Rojava plan, and then I'm wondering what that Rojava plan has to do with the
Nazis. That I have no idea. Those are the Rojava plan, the lines of Rojava, basically the same people, those are the ones who got me over there, for all intents and purposes. So I can vouch for, I mean, I'm in contact with those guys, so I can vouch for that website. Some of their analysis is a little bit heavy-handed, but... You know, if you don't want to get over to Rojava, that's one of the websites that you probably need to visit and get in contact with.
And they still suggest
that they suggest that, but again, I mean, when they found that I was there and ready to go, they had no problem getting me across the border as rapidly as possible. So, yeah, no, I really appreciate those guys.
Did you take that class at Rojava?
No. No, I didn't. Yeah, no, I was a bad traveler as usual.
Oh, you said that part
of the entrance visa. Yeah, they asked that you complete a 2-month course in Kurmanji, and that, you know, you complete. I think that, you know, you read up on it. They provide you with some of the reading material. So, you know, of course, being a good anarchist, I don't follow directions very well. So I just showed up in Istanbul, begging them to get me across the border, which they did. So I have no problem with that. But they would be, if you're interested in getting over there, those would be some of the people that would give you a hand, because then they put you in contact with people who are actually in Rojava and who will Skype back and forth with you to help you get through. Because I'm sure that with all the presentations that I've done, I'm sure that a press pass at Semelka does not get you across that border anymore. I've said it too many times. Please.
You mentioned seeing oil wells in Rojava. What is their relationship?
Right now, Rojava, that area in Rojava, they are sitting on top of 60% of all the oil reserves in Syria, but they've allowed those oil wells to, many of them, to go derelict. And they've done that for a reason. They really have not wanted to pump it out, and they haven't had a way to be able to transport it, and they've not wanted to put it anywhere where it could be destroyed. So they have just been, for all intents and purposes, have been leaving the oil in the ground, and they think they'll probably decide about it later. One of the really interesting discussions I had with some of the folks who were there from the Netherlands that I met in Kamishli was, we were talking about currency and what currencies could be based on. And we were all thought that wouldn't it be interesting if Rojava decided to base a currency on oil? and oil futures, you know. So that would be, you know, as opposed to cutting it loose. And also, you know, that would also, they're trying, they would, one of the things that the Rojava is obviously going to have to do is to try to figure out ways so that their currency won't be speculated against, which is always one of the most dangerous things for a revolutionary government, right? So, or revolutionary organization, what have you, area. Please.
It's not, I think there is something about, is that, who is that, is it what it's in, is that, but when you're trying to understand better, what is that, the role played by the people in terms of organizing the economy, the workers and the places, you know, to be,
Right. Right. Well, in terms of PKK, you mean their ideas or how they're doing it?
Yes.
Okay, so the ideas are encapsulated in democratic confederalism. It's a little bit too, I mean, we've kind of gone over some of that material. So, you know, the concept being is to decentralize power, to, in one way or another, interact with capitalism, to basically defang it some way. In other words, to with private property, maybe make private property one of use, that type of thing. But PKK and PYD are not responsible for that implementation. That implementation is responsible to a non-governmental organization called TEDDA, which is doing the implementation in Rojava. And that's a, that organization is has representatives of all the political parties as well as individuals within the area. And they're the ones who are the responsible party for implementing this democratic confederalism. So, as I said, PYD, when you're there in Rojava, has been effectively sidelined. You almost never hear about it. You almost never see a PYD flag anymore. But TEDDEM is becoming very, very, very important as they evolve structures to be able to push more and more power into the communities and make the communes begin more and more responsive to the needs of the families that they represent. So it's a good question. Please.
So is Syria like a lot of other Arab countries in the sense that the oil field workers are usually desk workers from other countries?
I have no idea. I didn't see any oil field workers because, as I said, they've allowed most of those things to go derelict.
I was just wondering if it's like that's why, because a lot of the workers tend to leave or
anything. Likely. I would also think that, most of those workers are likely from Damascus and Aleppo and would only be moving through Rojava to do, you know, maintenance, that type of thing. I know that there were a number of French concessions there because I was reading a lot of French signs on some of the oil barracks. So that was kind of what I got out of it. But I would assume, yeah, likely individuals. Again, there it seems to vary from place to place. So Tangiers, I guess, is one of the places that guest workers come from, as well as Pakistan. So, yeah.
I just want to ask, what is the attitude or perspective? Hear anything in Rojava of joy, people from Palestine and folks in Africa?
The only thing that I really heard in terms of external folks is that they really wanted people, I mean, the people involved in the Rojava Revolution really want people to know that they're not doing this to kill Daesh. That's not why they're fighting. They're fighting to win a revolution. And they also recognize that what they're doing there may affect what's going on in some of these other places. But they're so deeply involved with what's going on there that I never even raised a question around Palestine or any of these other things with them. So yeah, I know it's a really good question. I honestly don't know the answer to that. I'm grimly happy with that.
Who else? And it's like, but we have this
Well, utopia is not being exploited by neoliberal globalism. I mean, that's the one thing. I mean, I think Rojava will be much happier when their oil goes off peak and they get rid of it. Because then they're just going to be able to grow food and, find their own way at that point in time. So, because the presence of that resource means that they're a target from some of the most evil people alive. Right? Bottom line. They're obviously going to make money off of it if they can, and they're making some money off of it. Now there's a little bit of oil coming out of the ground. But the real concern is that, I'll give you an example with Barzani. Classic example. Kurdish regional government. The Bush administration said, you guys rise against Saddam Hussein, we'll give you a country. And they completely didn't believe him. What's the first thing they did? They approached Texaco, Sunoco, BP, and said, let's start cutting out concessions now because we recognize you guys with the money are going to be telling Bush what to do. Right? So that's ultimately the problem. You know, it's countries that have no valuable resources are kind of off the hook. Yeah, they live a little bit poorer, but they live a little bit freer. Right? So, at least that's my call. I mean, I'm sure, there are millions of different attitudes. There's probably 3 million attitudes in Rojava alone that would counter mine, but that's kind of my attitude. Is that, sitting on top of oil is no blessing. Not with the people currently running the economy in the world. Yeah. Right?
Well, I guess. Let me just say real quick. I don't know if you have a question, but we might wrap it up soon. But all the stuff on the back tables is free. There's actually copies of all the statues and the wealth models in Rojava. If you want, please take some. And all the newspapers and stuff, if you want to take one back to your workplace, or friend, please take some. But definitely take that copy of all the statues. Everything's free. And thanks to everybody who said you donated. And just give a round of applause.
I guess we're probably going to break out. I don't know if we're going to do this picture or not, but we really want to do a picture of as many folks as we possibly can so that I can send it off to the people in Rojava so that they get it, they understand the people who care. So if you're interested, please come up to the stage and we'll see if we can get a picture. And I think we've got a camera here that's probably gonna, there we go. So please do.